National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Early last month, lawmakers in Washington State enacted a new law. It was set to take effect in late July. And what is it going to do? Well, it's going to mandate Catholic priests to report child abuse they learn about in the context of confession. In other words, forcing priests to risk automatic excommunication from the church for breaking the seal of confession, the sacramental seal. What does this mean for the church in the Northwest and across the country in other legislative hotspots? This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Register staff writer Jonah McCowan. And then, a month has passed since the election of Pope Leo XIV, and Register senior editor Jonathan Liedl discusses how the new pontiff has settled in and what we can discern about his impending decisions for the church. Hello, and welcome to Register Radio. I'm your host, Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director for EWTN News, joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you, Shannon?
Good to be with you, Matthew.
Having a hard time grasping that we're already in the summer. It feels as though we were all the way back in February, just a couple of days ago.
I know, and you and I sort of skipped over spring because you were in Rome. So
that's exactly right. Well, a lot is happening here in the United States at the same time, as well as in Rome. As I was just mentioning, early last month, lawmakers in Washington State enacted this new law. Essentially, it forces Catholic priests to report child abuse that they hear about, essentially, in the confessional. The new law, which is being opposed, obviously, vigorously by Washington State's bishops, is being investigated also by the U.S. Department of Justice. It makes Washington, however, the first state to pass a law directly attacking the confessional seal since the abuse crisis burst back into the scene in the summer of 2018. It raises also the question, not just of what's happening in Washington State, though, what about legislative hotspots, states where Catholics, both clergy and laity, are fiercely contesting laws and bills that fly in the face of Catholic values and practices? Well, to talk about this, as I just mentioned, too, is Jonah McCowan, who is a Register staff writer. And Jonah, welcome back to Register Radio. It's been a while since you've been on our show.
Thanks so much, Matthew. Yeah, it's great to be back on, and now in this new capacity as a staff writer for the Register.
Yeah, I can chime in on that, Jonah. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the National Catholic Register. Just a little bit for our listeners about Jonah. He's been with EWTN for, correct me if I'm wrong, Jonah, 7 years, right? And he's been working during that time as a staff writer for Catholic News Agency. And Joan and I worked at CNA together for a few years. He's sort of our do-everything guy at EWTN. So in addition to writing some wonderful features and some really hard-hitting news stories, Jonah was also a principal figure behind CNA's, unfortunately dormant, but excellent podcast that was, Jonah, really a labor of love for Jonah.
I was a big fan of that podcast, not just because I was on it every once in a while.
And he's also has really contributed to CNA and EWTN, providing a lot of interactive graphics to help our readers track things like state abortion initiatives and ballot drives and things like that. So he can do a little bit of everything and do it really well. So welcome, Jonah.
Yeah, thank you so much, Shannon. It's great to be working for you again. As you mentioned, I spent seven years almost at CNA, and a couple months ago made the short hop over to the Register. And it's been great so far.
Yeah, and I just want to maybe tee up this particular story that you worked on. So, you know, CNA, we rely so much at the Register on CNA's reporting, and they create a lot of the data points that the Register is able to sort of connect the dots, and that's something that Jonah will be doing going forward. In this case, you know, CNA has been reporting on these various developments at the state level. Jonah, We are coming up on the third anniversary of Dobbs next week, and this is another reminder that as much of the focus is on Washington and Donald Trump, the real action legislatively is happening at the state level.
Yes, that's definitely right. As many listeners, I'm sure, will be well aware, 3 years ago, Roe v. Wade was overturned, and so that really returned a lot of the ability for state lawmakers to legislate on the abortion issue. And unfortunately, what we've seen for several years following the Dobbs decision is a lot of losses at the ballot box for these abortion initiatives that Catholics have very much opposed every time they've come up. But unfortunately, a lot of them have passed, even in states with a lot of pro-life voters, one of them being my home state of Missouri, unfortunately. But there was kind of a turning point last November in the November 2024 election when several states, most notably Florida, actually voted against some pro-abortion initiatives. So that was really kind of seen as a little bit of a turning point and good news in the pro-life movement. But as my article in the Register kind of discusses, there are a lot of other issues that Catholics should and are very interested in that are going on right now that don't necessarily have anything to do with abortion. A lot of them do have a lot to do with, pro-life issues and the culture of life. But, many of these issues, including the recent bill related to the seal of confession in Washington state. Again, these aren't necessarily related to abortion, but they're very, very important. And, there's a lot of kind of national pressure on a lot of these states to pass bills that Catholics are rightly very upset about. And so, like you said, at the Register and at EWTN in general, we really try to connect those dots for the readers and help them understand what's going on in the country. And then again, on the local level, if listeners are listening in Washington state, they need to know how this will affect them and how Catholics are responding. So hopefully we can continue to do that.
Yeah, on that Washington state piece of legislation, I mean, it's astounding to constitutional observers, a few that I've talked to, that they would even bother to pass this because it so clearly is a violation of First Amendment. Now, granted, it's going to be going through the courts now, I'm sure. But what was the thinking? What was the rationale behind the bill in the first place?
Well, it was introduced by a Democrat from Seattle, and it was signed into law by Governor Bob Ferguson. And he actually used to be the Attorney General of Washington, so he did some investigation of the state's diocese related to abuse. So it was really framed as kind of the next logical step, if you will, to make all clergy mandated reporters if they learn about child abuse. And of course, there are many other professions like teachers and of course law enforcement officials who are mandated reporters. But for basically the past 200 years or so, there's been a recognition in many aspects of the law that there is a very important privilege for clergy between clergy and penitents. Mm-hmm. This is really a very important aspect that needs to be preserved, even within this extremely, extremely important realm of protecting children. I mean, this is something that, of course, the church has responded to and continues to respond to. To your question, why was this passed in the first place? It does seem as though it was framed by its supporters as, well, why wouldn't we do this? If our goal is to protect children, why wouldn't we do this? But, a huge aspect of the Catholic pushback is pointing out, well, in every single diocese in Washington, priests and clergy are already mandated reporters. I mean, they are required to look very, very carefully for signs that children might be abused or that someone is committing that. But that being said, there is a recognition of this extreme sacredness of the sacrament. And you know, there's no suggestion that the sacred seal of the sacrament could be breached even for this reason.
Now, Jonah, just speak to a little bit of the lawsuit that has triggered, and sort of what's next to fall in Washington State.
Yes, so the Catholic bishops of Washington State have filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington, basically just challenging mainly on First Amendment grounds this law. And the last I've heard, I believe there is a hearing scheduled roughly a month from now, because as Matthew mentioned, the law isn't actually set to take effect until July 27th. So there's a little bit of time to contest it in court, but there's some local Washington State law firms that are kind of leading on this, as well as the firm Beckett, which is a national law firm. So I guess we will just have to see what happens between now and the hearing that's scheduled for mid-July.
Yes, in the brief time that we have left, let's focus also on assisted suicide in Illinois and very notably New York.
Yes, absolutely. So unfortunately, as people may have heard, there was an assisted suicide bill that was passed recently in New York and has now headed to the desk of the governor, Kathy Hochul. And she is Catholic. She's worked with the local archdioceses in New York State on certain things before. She is a Democrat. And we've kind of been advised by the state Catholic conference that it's not 100% clear whether or not Governor Hochul will actually sign this bill into law and authorize assisted suicide in New York State. Obviously, the bishops there have spoken out very greatly against this mm-hmm. because as Catholics, we're called to accompany people to the end of their life, not hasten the end. And so, there's been a lot of pushback, especially from Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, because he really pointed out that Governor Hochul has tried to do a lot to help people with their mental health. And obviously, authorizing assisted suicide in the state really undermines that goal. So,
Jonah, thank you so much for your reporting on this. The name of your piece is Blue States, Hot Debates. Catholics respond as hotspot states continue to pass problematic bills. You can find that at ncregister.com. Well, welcome back once again. And I know that both Shannon and I look forward to having you on frequently.
Thank you so much, Matthew and Shannon. It's been great to be with you.
Well, when we come back, we talk to Jonathan Liedl, Register Senior Editor, about Pope Leo XIV's first month. This is Register Radio. Please don't go anywhere.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News, of course, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, since Pope Leo XIV's election on May 8th, our new Holy Father has settled into his new office as head of the Church with remarkable ease. And the world has welcomed him with genuine enthusiasm, including, notably, the Chicago White Sox, Pope Leo's lifelong favorite baseball team. Well, how has it gone, and where might we be headed? We're joined now by Jonathan Liedl, Register Senior Editor. Again, Senior Editor for the National Catholic Register. Welcome, Jonathan.
Great to be with you guys.
Well, it is always remarkable to think that it's already been more than a month since the election of Pope Leo, especially because he seems to have transitioned so smoothly that it feels as though he's been Pope for a lot longer than that. What do you think?
Yeah, I liked in your description at the beginning, Matthew, you used the term this ease, this kind of stepping into the role and just seeming like a very pontifical figure from the get-go. And I think that is an observation, that's an insight, I think, shared by a lot of people across the Catholic Church. I think you can't help but look at the ways that Pope Leo is continuing, but also charting his own path when compared to Pope Francis. And I think one thing that a lot of people are pointing out is that is that Pope Leo, he just seems like a normal pope, right? Pope Francis was very unique, right? As as a pope, he in some ways was disruptive. He deviated from different traditions. And I think Pope Leo, right out the gate, has put a lot of people at ease by whether it's, you know, what he's wearing liturgically, some of the the use of Latin also in the liturgy, but even the way he speaks and gives his homilies and presentations, a kind of almost reservedness and a real deliberative sense in the way he chooses his words, which might be something of a bit of a departure from Pope Francis's more spontaneous style.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it's a departure, but not a rejection of Pope Francis.
Every pope is going to have their own personal style because they're an individual person with their own personality. So looking back to previous popes, we can see how John Paul II was a rock star, right? He had this charisma. He could captivate an entire crowd. He was followed by Benedict XVI, who, of course, was more reserved, right, in his, you know, more favored those kind of more intimate exchanges with people, and definitely an intellectual and a scholar in his own right. So every pope is going to have their own personality and leave their own stamp on the papacy. I do think we, you know, yeah, I think you're right, Matthew, that we can't, like, overstate, you know, for instance, Pope Leo, just recently it was announced that he's going to restore the custom of imposing the pallium, this kind of band for archbishops signifying their role as shepherds. He's going to do that in Rome on June 29th instead of sending them home with the pallium, you know, that Francis did. But I don't think we can read into some of these little deviations or little tweaks in how he is exercising the office of the papacy and say, that it's like a complete sort of rejection of the previous pontificate or anything like that. Because, as I'm sure we'll get into, there are some important ways that Leo himself has signaled that he wants to continue some of the initiatives that Francis began.
Yeah, there haven't been any great aha moments, you know, where the we can see very clearly what Leo's agenda is. But there have been, you know, decisions that he has made. One of the things that's being very closely watched is how he'll manage the Vatican-China Accord. I know there was reports of the naming of a bishop in China. And the other big one is the Father Marco Rupnik scandal, right? There's been no official action taken yet against him in a Vatican court, but a small little signal, the Dicastery for Communications, which it took a lot of heat for featuring art by Father Rupnik on its website and its promotions of different Catholic feast days and so on. That art has kind of suddenly disappeared.
Abruptly, yes.
We also have a new appointment of a U.S. bishop in Louisiana. So there are a few things that we can kind of examine, right, early stage.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Shannon, that we can begin to sort of see these areas of continuity, but also going in a different direction. One of them, the big one you mentioned, I mean, Rupnik, right? We know that Father Marco Rupnik has been credibly accused by 20-some women of sexual abuse, including in the course of the production of his mosaics, of his artwork. We also know that previously, even the prefect of the Dicastery for Communications, Paolo Ruffini, told American journalists that there was no need to remove his artwork from the Vatican website, and that people were wrong to call for that and to suggest that it might be a gesture of solidarity with victims of sexual abuse. And within one month of Leo, as you know, this change in the pontificate, suddenly the artwork disappears, right, from the Vatican website. So, I mean, it's very... The most reasonable conclusion to draw there is that for whatever reason, that change wasn't possible or wasn't prioritized by Pope Francis, who, you know, we know was a fellow Jesuit with Father Rupnik before Rupnik was kicked out of the Jesuits, and who we also know that Pope Francis had artwork by Father Rupnik in his private apartments. That's a significant change there. I think there are clear ways in which Leo, though, on some big theological issues and other issues in governance of the church, is going to continue what Francis began, but we're waiting to see how he will do it. I think one thing to point out, for instance, And Matthew, I have in mind an exchange you have with Cardinal Czerny in the back of my mind as I'm sharing this. But we know that Pope Leo went ahead with an appointment that Francis had lined up and made Franciscan Sister Tiziani Merletti the secretary of the Dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. And of course, a big change made during the Francis pontificate was shifting women into these leadership roles within Vatican dicastery. So the governance, basically, of the Vatican, the Curia. A secretary is the number two position, but of course, Francis did make a woman a prefect in charge of the dicastery. And that prompted a ton of conversation about the connection between holy orders, right? So a man ordained to, on behalf of the church, be the priestly office, the prophetic office, and the kingly office. And there was a question about whether that was being, by having lay people, including women, take these roles, was that being, that link being broken? And Matthew, I don't know if you'll recall, I think it was 2023 at the October Synod, Cardinal Czerny told you, we have overcome that connection, right? Like, so
yes,
this
exactly.
idea, exactly. So Leo seems to not have a problem with that sort of development of the understanding of church leadership, governance in some ways, and holy orders. I think
that was a point that was raised in the general congregations among the cardinals. I think it was Cardinal Beniamino Stella who was made a cardinal by Pope Francis, but actually stood up and complained about that very point of that separation.
You know, the appointment, from what I've heard, was sort of one that was already on the books, right? That Pope Francis had already approved. And so, you know, you could kind of like say, well, was it really fully Leo's appointment? But nonetheless, he affirmed it, right? He confirmed that a Franciscan sister is now the number two of this Vatican dicastery. And of course, you know, the heads of dicasteries are sort of, I kind of think, you don't want to over-politicize thing, but the Pope is, you know, he's the Bishop of Rome, and he's also, you know, this visible sign and source of unity for the worldwide Catholic Church. So he's providing governance to the Catholic Church. And the Curia, the court, it's almost like the executive branch, like these different agencies that are helping the Pope out in different aspects of ministry, whether it's doctrine, whether it's evangelization. So the heads of these dicasteries do give dictates, basically, to bishops in other parts of the world with the authority of the Pope. So it is a very real question if a woman, or really a non-cleric, right, a non-ordained person, male or female, is telling a bishop how to govern his diocese, telling a bishop how to teach in his diocese or how to sanctify his diocese, when he uniquely has the munere, the gifts to do those kinds of things. So it's a big question, but I think there's no reason to think that Leo is going to deviate from the course that Francis has set. One thing I want to bring up, of course, is synodality, right? This term synodality, which means journeying together and has become kind of a concept for thinking about improving inclusion and participation in the life of the Catholic Church. And this was a major cornerstone of Francis's pontificate. He established a synod for synodality that, before he passed away, also said that the process is going to continue for about four more years. There was a lot of question of, you know, how long will this concept of synodality even last a minute beyond the Francis papacy? And I think pretty clearly it will. You know, Pope Leo, in his opening address from the Loggia of St. Peter's Basilica, talked about a synodal church. In a recent address to an ecumenical gathering, including Orthodox Christian leaders, he talked about the importance of synodality. So we don't know exactly what he'll emphasize in synodality, how he'll push those reforms forward, how he'll codify them, how he might clarify some definitions, who he might bring to the table to figure those things out. But I think at the same time, there's no reason, at least from my perspective, to think that he's going to kind of pull the handbrake on the synod on synodality or cancel the upcoming gathering in 2028, for instance. So that's a clear indication of some degree of continuity there.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that as a canon lawyer, I think it was one of the reasons that he had some appeal to the cardinals who voted for him, that you mentioned comparing this to the government. It does seem to me that this was a previous pontificate that relied very heavily on motu proprio, and mm-hmm. I think it has raised a lot of canonical and theological questions that presumably Pope Leo now is going to have to contend with. And in terms of the appointments and synodality, it's going to be very interesting to see what he does with that gathering in 20, 28, isn't it?
Early on, I think in the first week of his papacy, Pope Leo hosted Jannik Sinner, the Italian tennis player. You know, Jannik Sinner, he had like some tennis balls and a tennis racket that he gave the Pope as a gift. And he kind of quipped like, hey, maybe we should play in here. We should play tennis right here in the Apostolic Palace, like in this, you know, magnificent hall with these priceless works of art around. And, you know, Pope Leo kind of joking, but he responded. He said, you know, we'll break something. Best not to. Right. And
right.
I think
exactly.
That to me was an insight into also how it seems like he'll lead the church, is very deliberative, is very concerned with making sure that changes are done in the least disruptive way possible.
And as Pope Leo also observed to the members of the Roman Curia, he said to them that the Curia, the popes pass, the Curia always remains. Well, thank you so much for listening. That is it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for a lot more of news, analysis, and commentary, go to ncregister.com. On behalf of Ace McKay, our producer for this week, and Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next time, please take care and God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.